I'm beginning to understand what they're saying, said Natalia, after they'd been at it for an hour. The way I see it, we're all sane, and the rest of the staff and doctors and superintendent are the lunatics. Sarah pointed at the head nurse, who was asleep at her desk. Completely daft. I like looking at it that way. Natalia glanced over at Sarah, who instinctively pulled in her stomach. You won't be able to hide it very soon. Sarah put a hand over her belly in a protective motion. What do you mean? You are with child. The simple statement brought pricks of tears to Sarah's eyes. Yes. The past couple of nights, in the depths of the bitter darkness, she'd imagined another world, one where she hadn't ventured to the States, where she'd stayed as head housekeeper at the Langham and never faced the corrosive effect of her own shame, her downfall. But she could no longer deny the truth, even to herself. What are you going to do? Natalia leaned in, her frown deepening the furrow between her eyebrows. I'm not sure what I can do. I'm amazed it survived Nurse Gaelic's attack. But it's moving. Growing. He or she. Not an it. I can't think about it that way. Her chest seized up and she fought to breathe. What will I do? What will they do with me once they find out? Natalia placed her hand on Sarah's, giving it a reassuring squeeze. I believe there's a place at the charity hospital for unwed mothers on the island. Maybe you can go there to have the baby. I heard the nurses talking about it. For husbandless women and fatherless children, they said. Always defined by a man, as if it weren't enough to be simply a woman or a child. Who is the father? She shuddered, unable to say his name. He doesn't know about it, or that I'm here. And he's not... free. You will need help when the time comes. What do they do with the babies that are born at the hospital? Do you know? Natalia shook her head. I'm sure they don't want the baby on their hands, another mouth to feed. This could be your key to getting out of here. Or it could be an excuse for them to lock me up for good and take the child away, as a way of further punishment. A couple of the women sitting at the adjacent table glanced in their direction. Sarah was certain they were foreign and didn't understand English, but she lowered her voice. I don't know what to do. What should I do? Natalia reached up and patted her cheek, her touch a cool salve. Don't worry. We'll figure it out. Do you know when the baby will be coming? In spite of her determination not to think ahead, she'd done the calculation over and over. Middle of August, I believe. I'll ask around. Try to find out if this has happened before. Nurse Alden is the kind one. I'll bring it up with her. Would you? It took everything Sarah had not to fall into Natalia's arms and burst into tears. Yes. We've made it this far. Let's see if we can make your situation work to your advantage. A week later, during their walk, Natalia pulled Sarah around the corner of the asylum, out of view of the nurses and other inmates. What is it? Is something wrong? Natalia's eyes sparkled. No, not wrong at all. Yesterday, I found Nurse Alden sitting in one of the offices working, alone. Tell me what you learned. She said that any inmate with child, and they have a few each year, is indeed sent to the charity hospital on the island, to the ward for unwed mothers. The hospital is for the people in the workhouse, right? Yes. It's going to be rough, but less rough than here, I would guess. How do we know, though? What if it's worse? The orderlies there are used to vagrants and drunkards and the like. Natalia lifted her chin and laughed. We are mad women, don't you remember? Do you think they are below us?
What are you ladies doing here?
Superintendent Dent strode over, pipe in hand.
You're not supposed to be off on your own.
Sorry, Superintendent Dent. Natalia did a combination head bow and curtsy, which seemed to mollify him slightly. He waved a hand.
Off you go. Breathe in the fresh air. It will help clear the mind.
Yes, sir. The next week, as they were at the beginning of their shift in the map-making factory, the head nurse called out from the doorway and motioned for Natalia and Sarah to grab one of the baskets of completed mats. These need to go to the penitentiary. Leave them by the front gate. Don't go inside. Here's a note in case anyone asks what you're doing. Yes, Mom. Sarah could hardly believe her good luck. They each took a basket handle and followed the road south. The walk provided a long-forgotten taste of freedom. A fresh breeze blew in from the west as they trod down the dusty road. The prison resembled a castle, with tiny square windows and turreted roofs. A rough wooden fence extended around the front entrance, with an iron gate in the center. Together they peered in. Men in black and white striped uniforms marched by in tight formation, each man pressed into the back of the one in front of him, while guards with rifles and sticks watched. One of the men noticed the women and whistled, and the guard lifted his stick and beat him soundly across the shoulders. Unwilling to draw any further attention to themselves, Sarah and Natalia crept away. Natalia pointed to the building next door. The hospital. Indeed, women in nurse uniforms stood outside the front entrance, enjoying the warm summer sun. Come with me. Natalia led Sarah up to the side of the building. Nurse Alden said the place for the women and babies is on the first floor. They peered in one window. The room had clean floors, whitewashed walls, and a bare bulb that hung from the ceiling. Plain linens and pillows adorned the beds, the blankets tucked in neatly around the corners. A couple of women sat in chairs, holding their babies, as a nurse fussed around them. Tears came to Sarah's eyes. It's so civilized.
Wish I could get a pillow. Almost forgot what it's like to sleep with one until now.
This will do, won't it? Sarah looked to Natalia for confirmation that she wasn't imagining things.
It will do very well. Tomorrow you go to Nurse Alden and tell her the truth. Ask her if she can arrange for you to have the baby at the charity hospital.
But we don't know what will happen after I've had the baby.
Women without husbands are put out on the street after 2 weeks. You'd be on your own after that, and with a child. No one will take you in or have you. But you can leave the baby with the Foundling Asylum on Lexington and 68th.
I couldn't do that. Put my own child in an asylum.
You could until you found work. A place to stay, at least.
Natalia was right. Sarah would be unemployable with a baby. But she didn't want to consider that right now. One step at a time. First, I have to get Nurse Alden on my side and get placed here when it's time. She gave Natalia a hug. Thank you for taking such good care of me.
Of course.
If I do get out, I'll come back for you, I promise.
I know you'll try.
Natalia's chin gave a wobble, the first time Sarah had seen her friend break down.
Maybe I can get with child as well, and follow your lead.
With Superintendent Dent, you mean? Natalia laughed in spite of herself, and Sarah put one arm about her friend as they headed back to the asylum. When the baby kicked, Sarah gave it a reassuring caress. Deep in the night, she dreamed that Nurse Gerlich was punching her in the stomach. She woke up in a sweat, rolled tightly into a ball.
but the pain wasn't imaginary. Every muscle in her body contracted as a wave of agony rolled through her. She willed herself to go back to sleep. Maybe she could go back into the dream and make it stop. But as her cries grew louder, the other women woke and shouted for her to be quiet. Doing so only made the pain worse. It was as though the baby was trying to claw its way out. With sweat pouring down her forehead, Sarah managed to call out for Natalia in a weak voice, before falling away, down a deep, dark hole, into nothingness.
Chapter 21. New York City, September 1985. The morning after her AA meeting, Bailey woke early and lay in bed staring up at the ceiling. In the past, the first few hours of the day were devoted to recovering from the evening before, the remainder to the business of figuring out where the best party was that night. She never drank alone. Instead, drinking and doing drugs were how she connected with others. After a couple of lines of cocaine, her life turned into one of those 1940s comedies starring Katharine Hepburn, with zingers flying back and forth, the world in sharp focus. Now the world was no longer quite as zippy, and she had yet to figure out how to fill that void, or, at the very least, how to sit with it for a while and see what transpired. Digging around the basement helped, as did her quest to discover more about Theodore Camden and Sarah Smythe. Bailey showered and was finishing up a bowl of granola when the workers showed up at the service entrance. She ran Melinda's latest whim by Steve and asked the crew to finish stripping the ornamentation from the library. Even the foreman shook his head before yelling instructions to his men in Spanish. She couldn't watch. Instead, she walked out into the bright, late summer day and jumped on the subway. The public library at 42nd Street was daunting, a giant block of carved marble guarded by two fierce lions. But she ventured inside and went up to a librarian with frizzy hair and round glasses, hoping the woman would be sympathetic instead of judgmental about Bailey's general lack of knowledge. Bailey's father had been upset that she hadn't applied to a real college, and made it abundantly clear that he considered her choice of career frivolous. I'm looking for information on an architect from the last century named Theodore Camden. The librarian didn't laugh or look annoyed. Follow me. She stood and led Bailey to a cabinet full of small drawers and pulled one out. Together, they scribbled down the call numbers of several books of architecture, and the librarian showed Bailey where to find them. The librarian even offered to do research into the name Sarah J. Smythe while Bailey read up on Camden. She spent a good hour poring through books on late 19th century architecture, filled with drawings and sketches and biographies. Theodore Camden's mentions were few, since he'd died so young, but she made note of the pertinent points, as if she were going to be tested later. By the end of 2 hours, her head was spinning from so much information. She stopped by the librarian's desk on her way out. The woman handed her a slip of paper. The microfiche department will have a number of newspapers that Sarah J. Smythe was mentioned in, and I've written down the names and dates.
Microfiche? How does that work?
You give them the information, then they'll get the film and show you how to use the machines. It'll take about 45 minutes for them to round up what you need.
She checked her watch. I'll have to come back.
Bailey thanked the librarian and headed uptown, where she supervised the workers until they broke for lunch. Bailey grabbed a sandwich from the deli and sat on a bench on Central Park West. When her mother had quit smoking, she'd taken up knitting, and Bailey figured keeping her own hands busy might help with her sobriety. On top of that, finding the cottage drawing from Theodore Camden had rekindled her need to create. She hadn't done much drawing since Parsons, but now, with extra time on her hands and such a grand subject at her disposal, she couldn't resist. Using a graphite pencil,
She blocked in the lines of the Dakota's upper gables before filling in the ornamentation with a rapidograph pen and then finishing with a watercolor wash. Pleased with the results, she moved to a different bench and started all over again, this time focusing on a turret on the south facade. The work calmed her, focused her. The quickness of the lines lent the building a kind of animation, as if it were breathing, alive.
"You taking some time off from decimating the building?"
Kenneth stood over her, leaning on his cane and staring down at her sketch with a big smile on his face. Bailey patted the bench next to her. "I thought I'd wait for the dynamite to take effect out here. Please, join me."
"Thank you, my dear."
He lowered himself down.
"That's quite lovely, I must say."
"I'm more than rusty. It's been a long time. But I love the building, and it's a challenge to capture it on paper." She put down her pen. "I remember seeing an article in Renzo's dad's scrapbook, written when the Dakota first opened, predicting it would be a landmark. I think they called it the Address of New York's West Side, or something like that."
"She's instantly recognizable, even 100 years later, our Dakota."
"I've been doing some research into an architect who lived here, Theodore Camden. When he died, he was on the verge of being really famous, because he was against all the crazy show-off architecture of the Gilded Age." Kenneth nodded.
"You know, I never really thought about the fact that it was called the Gilded Age, as opposed to, say, the Golden Age. That the era was all about money and the illusion of success, as opposed to offering anything truly valuable. Reminds me of New York City these days, to be honest with you."
He had a good point. Rolex watches flashed on the wrists of bankers. Consumption was king, and everyone she knew partied like there was no tomorrow. "But if the Dakota is an example of the Gilded Age, with all that crazy ornamentation, why do we care about saving it?" Kenneth's eyes lit up.
"Smart girl. By your logic, the Dakota's chaotic array of dormers and finials are the late 19th century equivalent of Melinda's mauve pedestal sinks and mirrored walls."
"Exactly. To me, the Dakota represents a moment in time, one that still resonates. I can't imagine mauve sinks holding up that long. Do you think in 30 or 40 years, people will mock what we're doing today?"
"More like 5 to 10, I would venture."
She burst out laughing. "You're probably right." A busload of tourists disembarked on the corner of 72nd Street. The guide pointed to the Dakota's front gate, the scene of Lennon's death, as they snapped photo after photo. Kenneth let out a low growl of disapproval. Bailey didn't want to be reminded of the recent notoriety. She preferred to stay in the past. Theodore Camden had a vision of what the city of the future should look like, and it wasn't all dolled up the way they liked it back then, but streamlined, sleek. She turned to him. "Did you ever hear anything about him having an affair with the woman who eventually killed him?" He turned to her in mock horror.
"How old do you think I am?"
"No, not personally. But maybe there were rumors that were passed down. It must have been a major event at the Dakota."
"What makes you ask?"
She explained to him about the drawing of the cottage and the photograph she found, and her possible connection.
"Let me ask around the old folks in the place and see what I can come up with for you,"
he offered.
"Even though I know a lot about the history of the place, much has probably been lost to time."
"I'm not sure if I want to be related to either Sarah Smythe or Theodore Camden, to tell the truth."
"Architects do have a reputation for being maniacs. Sarah Smythe seemed to be one already. But, from what I can tell, all your marbles are intact."
If he only knew. One drink and her marbles had a tendency to ricochet about like pinballs. That's very kind of you to say, but I'm not so sure. I don't know which is worse, to know your family tree, warts and all, or remain blissfully ignorant. Growing up, my family was always such a mystery. My grandfather was clearly unhappy about being thrown out of the Camden fold at the age of 15, and my father kept up the grudge. I guess I do too, to be perfectly honest. She considered her terrible behavior of the past year, her lack of connection with pretty much anyone, about as far from blissful ignorance as one could get. We're three generations of loners. Kenneth stared at her with sad eyes, as if he knew what she was thinking.
Deep down, you want to be part of something. I understand that. That's why I cling hold of my apartment so tightly. It's something that's mine, and holds all my memories.
I wonder if that's why Theodore Camden did that drawing for Sarah Smythe. So she could have her own home full of memories as well.
We are a couple of romantics, aren't we?
I suppose.
But enough dreaming.
He banged his cane on the ground.
Let's get down to business. I want that sketch of the Dakota you just did, and I'll pay you for it.
Don't be silly. You can have it. The least I can do for all the aggravation Melinda's caused.
Nope. This has nothing to do with Melinda. You're an artist, and I won't have it any other way.
Kenneth insisted she come up to his apartment so he could finalize the transaction. He disappeared into his bedroom, and she wandered over to the mantel, where a photo of Kenneth and a young boy of about 12 sat in a silver frame. Kenneth returned, counting out $10 bills. She pointed to the photograph. This is Manville. Kenneth beamed.
Dear boy, he'd often come up here to hide out from whatever world war was raging in Sophia's apartment. Melinda and Sophia were hard-headed, and Manville is not, sweet child. Couldn't have been more different from his twin. Interested in paintings, music. Oscar was an art dealer, and Manville learned from him. Eventually decided to devote himself to art history and criticism. We were so proud.
In the photo, they were seated on a couch, laughing at something. She hadn't seen Manville in years, but his thick mane of hair and skinny limbs were instantly recognizable, as if he had the head of a lion and the legs of a foal. Melinda said he's working in outsider art. What's that all about?
Work done by untrained artists ranges from paintings to sculpture. It's an interesting niche, especially down south.
I'm sure he was dying to get as far away from New York as possible. Melinda used to torture him. He sighed.
There's something about this building that seems to tear families apart. Maybe I'm being dramatic, but even the builder of the place, Edward Clark, left the building in his will to his 14-year-old grandson instead of his son.
Why?
Because his son preferred to hang out with the more artistic types, shall we say, chorus boys and the like. And consider the Camdens. Sophia left the apartment to Melinda and Manville equally, but I doubt Manville knows that she's ripping it to pieces. Not that he'd care, to be honest. The trappings of civilization were never important to that boy.
Kind of a free spirit, huh?
Exactly right.
What about you and Oscar? You were a happy family, it seems. He sighed.
We were. But even Oscar, my beloved, was cruel to me at the very end.
In what way? She'd imagined the affair as passionate, the two of them gleefully living together in this luxurious apartment in the sky with Nureyev and Lauren Bacall popping in to say hello.
Oscar became angry and paranoid as his mind went. He'd accuse me of stealing from him. Told me that he'd take me out of his will. Then the next day, forget everything and be loving and kind. After he died, I figured I was safely ensconced here. But Sophia had the nerve to challenge my right to the apartment. I'm sure she imagined joining the two together with a spiral staircase.
Kenneth looked up, as if a drill might break through at any moment before giving a half-shrug.
The building is chock-full of misfits and betrayal. Wealthy people using their assets to control their loved ones. That's true anywhere, of course, but at the Dakota, it's amplified 1,000 times.
Why is that?
Imagine the building back in the day, this vast fortress looming over Central Park. No one in their right mind would move so far uptown. It was a risk. The tenants at the very get-go had a lot to prove, is my guess. They had cash, but no cachet. Speaking of...
He handed her 10 crisp $10 bills. That's far too much.
I simply must have this, and you deserve every penny.
His kindness made her ache inside, but in a sweet way. He'd been through so much. Bailey raced to the bodega and bought 12 donuts for the workers to share her unexpected bounty. Upstairs in Melinda's apartment, most of the mahogany was off the walls. Bailey grabbed the key to the storage room that Renzo had given her and led the way down the service elevator to the basement. The guys heaved the wood on their shoulders, maneuvering with care as they turned the corners. Renzo's office door was wide open, the light on. She poked her head in and dropped off one of the donuts, wrapped in a paper napkin on his desk. Pathetic, really, the way Renzo's kindness last night had turned her into a puppy, eager for attention. Awareness was key, Bates said in rehab. In the past, she would have been blind to her tendency to glom on to anyone who showed her attention. Sure, she was glomming, but she was aware she was glomming. Progress, perhaps. In any case, the cardinal rule of AA, no relationships until 1 year clean, was one she was more than happy to obey. Life was confusing enough in the harsh light of sobriety. In return for feeding me last night? Renzo looked up and smiled.
Fantastic. I was just thinking I needed to eat.
She stood there, awkward as a teenager at a dance. Okay if the guys start loading in some of the treasures?
Go right ahead. Let me know if you need any help.
She watched as they stacked up the wood before covering it with packing blankets. Not much else could be done, unfortunately. If there was a flood or fire, it would all be ruined. But at least it hadn't been tossed into the back of a garbage truck and dumped in a landfill. After the guys went back upstairs, she turned to the trunks. The bottom one's lock was tricky, even though she'd brought down a paperclip that she figured might finagle it. Renzo walked past as she struggled, trying to find the point of release.
You need help?
You know how to break and enter? He studied the lock, retrieved his toolbox from his office, and knelt down with a small screwdriver in hand.
Let's see if this works. Is this another Sarah Smythe drunk?
No, I think it's Theodore Camden's. Bailey watched as he fiddled with the lock. I've been doing some research at the library into his life. He was way ahead of his time.
Too bad he died so young, then.
Renzo sprayed some WD-40 into the lock. Right. Like Lennon. She paused, unsure how to continue and unable to read his face. Melinda said your dad was here when he was shot.
He was. It tore him up that he didn't prevent it from happening. After John and Yoko moved in, there were so many fans trying to get access to him, leaving letters, trying to call upstairs, sneaking in. He wished he'd hired more security, done something more.
Why do you think Yoko stayed on?
A way of keeping his memory alive, I guess. Lauren McCall's still here, even though Bogey died in the late 50s. It's a tough place to leave, I guess I'm a prime example.
I'm sorry your dad felt responsible. I mean, think of all the celebrities who live in Manhattan. There's no way to protect them all the time, especially when people are so crazy. Like, really crazy.
True. In any event, before then, my old man and I had fallen out of touch. We didn't have much contact, and then he died.
I'm sorry. She knew all about how a loved one's sudden death could eat away at you, with so much left unsaid. As a form of penance, maybe, Renzo had taken over a super, fighting a losing battle against pipes and fixtures that were falling to pieces. His way of keeping his dad's building, or, more likely, his memory, intact. The lock clicked open. Inside, dozens of leather tubes lay stacked one on top of another. She lifted one out and carefully pulled off the top. A roll of cream-colored linen slid out easily. Renzo laid it out.
Architectural plans.
The drawings were gorgeous, a feast for the eyes, the elevations exquisitely rendered and detailed. At the bottom of each page was written, Theo Camden, architect. The exact signature that she'd seen on the cottage drawing. Beautiful, Bailey said. Maybe I'll frame them and have them line the gallery upstairs. What a find. Together they looked through each one. The tubes had preserved the linen and ink, so they looked like they had been drawn a week ago, the lines sharp and dark. Bailey pulled out another. This one isn't in the best condition. Looks like something messed it up. The drawings were stained with what looked like Rorschach blots. Underneath them was the design for a 20-story building that stuck to strict neoclassical proportions with a solid base, each floor of windows bordered by fluted columns. But the ornate details, so popular in the late 1800s, had been replaced with a cleaner, more stripped-down facade. It announced a new, modern century on the horizon. Renzo pointed to the description at the bottom right.
American Insurance Company, Albany, New York. It's dated November 1885.
What is this stuff on it? She ran her finger lightly over several dark and crusty stains. Guess these can't be framed. Too bad. I like how it's different from the others. She picked up the tube and heard a rattle. When she turned it over, a piece of metal dropped out, along with some kind of stick. What on earth? Bailey picked up the metal and held it to the light. About 5 inches in length, it was covered partly in the same dark substance the drawings were. But the clean half glinted in the light. A dragon's face, or maybe an alligator, had been shaped in gold and silver with a delicate cross-hatching. She offered it to Renzo. His eyes grew wide.
Wait here. Holy shit. Put it down really carefully and don't touch it, and I'll be right back.
She placed it on the top of the trunk and leaned down to get a better look. She was tempted to scratch away the yucky crust and see what was beneath, but Renzo was back a moment later holding a newspaper.
I saw this a couple of days ago. Look at this.
An old black-and-white photo showed a knife with a carved metal handle partially pulled out of a sheath. The sheath that was right in front of them. What is this? She began reading as Renzo explained.
Some construction workers found the knife a week ago in Central Park when they were excavating for strawberry fields. It's really old, from Tibet, and disappeared from the collection of a wealthy family named Rutherford in the 1880s.
And it was only just discovered?
Yes. They're trying to figure out how it got there. Right now it's at the Met being examined, as there are no descendants of the Rutherford family left to claim it. It says here that the sheath hasn't been recovered.
She stared at the object. It was in Theodore Camden's trunk, who was stabbed to death
in November 1885, the same month as on the drawings.
What about this?
Renzo reached over and picked up the stick that had fallen out of the same tube.
Some kind of drawing tool?
It reminded her of a rook piece from a chess set, one that had been worn smooth over time. That's not a pencil. Sarah turned to Renzo in horror. You're holding Theodore Camden's missing finger.
What?
Renzo croaked.
The bone from his finger. It was cut off during his murder and never found. They thought it might have been taken as some kind of grisly souvenir.
To his credit, he didn't drop the bone to the floor. Instead, he waited until Bailey had grabbed two tissues from his office and laid the bone on one and the sheath on the other before carefully folding them up like a pair of newborns being swaddled.
The sheath must be worth a ton of money, said Bailey. The Met is going to flip out when they see that we found this.
The paper says the knife is worth around $500,000. It's from the 16th century.
To think, the knife and sheath have been not 300 yards from each other all this time?
I wonder how they got separated.
A draft ran over the back of her neck and she shivered. I wonder how his finger ended up down here. Together, they went back through all the trunks, but more carefully. Bailey checked inside the pockets of the dresses, in the very corners of each trunk, looking for clues. In Minnie Camden's trunk, she took out a small red silk purse edged with metallic gold lace. Inside was a piece of paper, as delicate as the crust of a creme brulee. My dear Christopher, I have been promised that you will receive this letter on your 21st birthday. I know it may be a shock, but I am proud to call you my son, even if you may be ashamed to see me as your mother. Indeed, I am, and everything I have done for you, to give you a better life. When you were a boy, I loved you and held you, and perhaps the fragile memories of that time still remain. No child should be denied what is true. Your father is Theodore Camden. I hope now you are 21, you are able to understand the circumstances that prevented you from knowing the truth, and to forgive. The name below was illegible, but Bailey was certain it began with an S. She showed Renzo the letter, shaking with exhilaration. The plot thickens.
Christopher wasn't a random ward.
He studied it closely.
You were right. He was Theodore Camden's son.
And Sarah's. Her cheeks burned with pleasure at the acknowledgement. She was a Camden, as was her father and her grandfather. This proved it.
I knew it. Doesn't this look like the letter S?
He squinted.
Not sure of that, but maybe. Where did you find it?
In Minnie Camden's purse, or at least the purse was in Minnie Camden's trunk.
Then maybe he was Minnie's child.
Why would she keep that a secret, though? Makes no sense. In any event, that's definitely not the word Minnie at the bottom.
The more she thought about the implications of the letter, the faster her heartbeat, excitement sizzled through her body. She handed him the sheath and the bone.
Take these and put them in a safe place. First thing tomorrow, I'll go back to the library and find out more about Sarah Smythe and the murder.
Shouldn't we contact the Met? Tell them what you've discovered?
We will, just not yet. You know what this means, don't you?
Renzo eyed her warily.
It means that I am a descendant of Theodore Camden. I'm sure of it.
Be careful what you wish for.
She gave him a quick peck on the cheek. The touch was electric. She hadn't meant it that way, just as a friendly, celebratory gesture. But he felt it, too, and pulled back.
Sorry, didn't mean to do that.
Her face got hot.
It's okay. Take it slow, though. Don't rush to conclusions.
Was he talking about their friendship or their findings? Either way, caution had never been her strong point.
Chapter 22. New York City. July, 1885. Sarah opened her eyes. It was dark outside, and while the pain had subsided briefly, she knew it would be back. During the lulls, she tried to take in where she was. The room wasn't in the charity hospital. She was sure of that. The bed was hard and the blanket rough, and she didn't see any other women in the throes of childbirth. The only other woman in the room, an old lady with a vacant stare and no teeth, got up and turned her back to squat over a waste pail, singing an off-key dirge about the devil. She was still in the asylum. The evening turned to day, and back into evening, and Sarah fought for breath and life, and pushed. The nurses, for the most part, ignored her. When one loomed over her with a grim mouth, Sarah grabbed her wrist. "I need to be taken to the charity hospital to have the baby. To the ward with unwed mothers." "What do you know about that?" The nurse pulled out of her grip. "In any event, they don't take crazies there. You'd disturb the rest of them." "I wouldn't. I know that's where I belong. Ask Nurse Alden." "You've been saying that the entire time you've been here. Enough, love. You checked in here as Mrs. Smythe. That place is for unwed mothers." She would have laughed if her situation weren't so dire. "It's too early to have the baby, isn't it?" "I don't know anything about that. You'll have to ask the doctor." Just then a wave of pain swept over her, and she forgot about everything except the muscles and nerves in her body, straining in a way that seemed physically impossible. Finally, the doctor arrived. Two nurses flanked him. The man was young, with bright blue eyes that darted around the room, taking everything in. He was from the outside and practically smelled of fear. A nurse pointed at Sarah. "She started up last night. We didn't know she was with child."
"How could you not know?"
The doctor sat on the edge of her bed and took out a stethoscope, which she placed against her belly. A rush of embarrassment was replaced by a sense of hope. Perhaps he could help.
"She didn't tell us nothing. We can't keep track of everyone in here, all 1,600. "Can she speak?"
He glanced up at the nurses. Thankfully, she was in between contractions.
"I can speak, doctor."
He looked down at her, startled.
"You're English."
He had a familiar accent of his own.
"And you're Welsh." "Indeed. Now why didn't you tell anyone about your predicament?"
Another cramp threatened, and she winced in pain.
"Get her some water, please."
The nurses moved on his command.
"I didn't know what they'd do to me." "Rather a ghastly place here, no?" "Yes. I was hoping I could be taken to the charity hospital on the island, the ward for unwed mothers." "You don't have a husband?" "No."
Her cheeks grew warm from shame. How far she'd fallen.
"Why were you put here in the asylum?"
"I'm not sure. They said I was acting funny, that I stole something, but I don't remember doing it. I was with child at the time. Maybe my mind wasn't right from that."
She should never have mentioned the theft. He straightened his spine.
"I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm afraid it's too late to go to the hospital. You'll have to have the baby here."
"It's so early. I didn't think it would come until August."
The cramp increased until she couldn't think or speak.
"Please don't go yet,"
she whispered. Tears of self-pity poured down her cheeks.
"What will happen to the baby after?"
"I don't know. This is my first week, and I'm not sure how it all works just yet. But don't worry about any of that right now. You need to keep your strength up so that you can deliver the baby."
He stood.
"Where are you from in Wales?"
She didn't want him to go just yet.
Swansea.
Is it lovely? It sounds lovely.
It's by the sea.
Do you miss it? She clenched her teeth, trying to keep them from chattering.
That's enough talk. I'll check on that water for you.
Please don't go. Please, please help me. He nodded.
I'll do everything I can.
After he strode away, she burst into sobs. She'd been doing so well for herself, in charge of her own life, running a giant building and its staff. And now she was helpless, trapped in a terrible place with no way out, nothing but pain and anguish pulsating around her. The kind manner of the doctor only served to remind her of all that she'd lost.
Stop wailing!
The nurses had returned. One lifted up her head and poured water into her mouth from a dirty tin cup, not caring that it spilled around the sides and dribbled down her chin and neck. The water tasted metallic, like something medicinal had been added to it. She tried to ask them what they'd given her, but her tongue became heavy and thick. A sea of sensations followed, but she couldn't figure out where the noises came from, or where she ended and the rest of the world began. She dreamed of the baby, and of her mother, the two curled up in bed together. In her vision, she drew closer, wanting to pick up the baby and hold her. But she drew back in horror when she realized they were both made of ice, cold to the touch, not human at all. She opened her eyes to the harsh summer sun streaming through the window. The room was empty. The humid air reeked of mold and rotting vegetables. Her entire body ached, as if she'd been trampled on by a horse, and her breasts were sore and heavy. She looked to either side of the bed for a crib, for some sign of her child.
There you are, then.
The doctor stepped into the room. His eyes had shadows under them.
How do you feel?
She tried to sit up, but her muscles refused.
Don't move. You'll need to rest.
The baby? He didn't answer her question.
The nurses said that you'll need to rejoin the other patients in a day or two. I tried to get them to give you a week to recover, but I'm afraid Superintendent Dent would have none of it.
She didn't care about that. But where's the baby?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Smythe. The baby died.
Sarah blinked through her tears. She hadn't admitted to herself how eager she had been to meet this creature, even if she was bringing it into a world of pain and misery. How? I felt it inside me. Was it too early? He frowned.
It was deformed, horribly deformed. To be honest, it's best it died, for otherwise it would be brought up in a place like this. And you wouldn't want that, would you?
She didn't answer. Can I see it?
It will be buried on the island. A boy was what you had. They bury them here. It was better you didn't see him. Something had gone terribly wrong.
Nurse Gerlich's beating had damaged the baby, just as she'd feared. He reached out and patted her hand.
In any event, you'll need to try to get stronger quickly. Don't let this bother you. Better this way, I assure you.
She turned away and covered her eyes with her hand. The baby had died, and the only thing ahead of her was more pain, more sitting, more cruelty. The child she'd carried, Theo's child, was now under the dirt somewhere on the island, in one of the unmarked graves she and Natalia had seen behind the charity hospital. No markers, just mounds of dirt that settled down as the bodies and flesh and bones melted down to nothing. She retched and the doctor jumped up.
I'll have the nurse bring you a bucket.
Sarah listened as his footsteps grew faint, replaced by the sounds of her own grief. Sarah had lasted 2 days back in her block, not talking, even to Natalia, not eating, and, more important, refusing to make mats.
before she was dragged away and placed in a cell on the top floor, the same one she'd been taken to after Nurse Gerlich's beating. Poor Natalia had tried to comfort her, had urged her to pull back from the dark place she'd been driven to by the baby's death. But Sarah would have none of it. She had been carved open by the pain and confusion of the birth, and there was no solace to be found. Not on Blackwell's Island. She lay curled up on the cot most of the day, lifting her head to watch the mice skitter across the floor and devour the tray that had been shoved through the opening under the door. How lovely to exist on instinct alone, to not know anything of the outside world and its delights and scandals. If she could have killed herself, she would have. One of the nurses had threatened to send her to the lodge if she didn't start obeying orders. "They'll toss you around like a rag doll, and you'll be screaming to be let back to your mates in no time," she'd said, sneering. Sarah had turned over to face the wall, and since then the food had stopped. She lost track of time. Maybe a week had gone by since the baby had died. Maybe 5 days. Maybe 5 months. None of it mattered anymore. The door latch clicked. "You'll stay in here until we know where to put you. Don't mind the dead body over there. She won't bother you." "Thank you, Nurse Cotter. I have your name right, don't I?" There was a long pause, long enough to make Sarah open her eyes. "That's right." "Very well. Thank you, Nurse Cotter." The nurse made a clucking noise and slammed the door shut. "Well, she's a delight." Sarah turned over and examined her new cellmate. The woman had survived the bathing process fairly unscathed. Her bangs were still curly and damp, and her neck and cheeks red. The woman thrust her hand out. "Well, hello there. I'm Nellie Brown." Sarah closed her eyes. Poor child. She was yet to be broken. "You all right?" Sarah hoped she'd get the hint and move to her side of the room, but no luck. Instead, she moved closer, studying Sarah like a work of art in a museum, which, in a way, was apt. All hard marble and stone, weighed down with no separation between her and the cot, her pedestal. "You don't look well. Is there anything I can do for you?" Sarah couldn't help it. She laughed. "Was that funny?" Sarah remembered the energy she'd brought with her to this place, trying to sort it all out and determine where she stood, how to get out.
"You oughtn't bother."
Her voice was weak.
"Oughtn't bother to do what?"
"Much of anything." Sarah sighed. The girl was not going to be ignored.
"There's no point."
The girl walked to the window and looked out.
"I can see the city from here."
"Seems so close, doesn't it?"
Nellie moved to her cot and sat down, tucking the calico dress under her legs.
"Do they not give you anything more than this to wear?"
Sarah shook her head.
"Even in winter?"
"We get coats to wear outside on the mandatory walks."
"Why are you here?"
She certainly got right to the point.
"I got into trouble at my work and ended up here. I'm not sure how."
"Are you crazy?"
Sarah shook her head. If anything, the agony of childbirth had strengthened her confidence in her own mental acuity. She had lost a child, and she was here against her will.
"No, not at all."
She sat up and crossed her arms in front of her.
"Are you?"
"No."
There was no explanation, no accusation of others, and no excuses.
"Then why are you here?"
"That's a very good question."
But Nellie didn't answer it.
"How long have you been here?"
"I came in January of this year."
"How many mad women would you say are in the asylum?"
"Patients."
"Sorry?" "Oh, right, patients. How many are there?"
1,600 or so.
As the afternoon sun made its way up the wall, Sarah found herself opening up more than she ever had, even to Natalia. Partly, she wanted to give this girl a better chance at navigating the dangerous channels of Blackwell's Island Insane Asylum. But she also wanted to be heard, one last time. She told her of the beatings, the mistreatment and torture of Marianne. Nellie asked questions but didn't seem overly shocked by any of it. Sometimes she repeated what Sarah had said. Maybe she wasn't very bright. The food came. The woman picked up both trays and brought Sarah one, laid it on her lap. I don't want to eat. I do, and I don't like to eat alone, so you'll have to indulge me. Sarah bit off a crust of bread, shocked to discover her stomach growling for more. Where did you used to work, before you were sent here? Asked Nellie. I worked at the Dakota apartment house. The woman put down her spoon. I read all about that building during the construction. In what capacity? I was the manageret. You were in charge? Under the managing agent, yes. Part of Sarah was pleased to be able to shock this woman. Part of her wanted to sober her up, make her see that the outlook wasn't good for either of them. You could be going along, living your life, and then see everything you've carefully built tumble down. She'd been worried about being with child, of how Theo would react. At the time, the problem seemed insurmountable, until something else came along, a trip on a ferry into hell, that made her earlier troubles almost trite in comparison. What happened? I was accused of stealing a necklace from one of the tenants. Did you do that? No. I don't know who did, but it wasn't me. For that, you were tossed in the madhouse? What was the point of playing games anymore? I had an affair with the husband of the woman who accused me. I think she may have found out. And had you committed? Set you up, you mean? Sarah had been turning the idea over in her head since her incarceration, trying to remember what had happened the days before the necklace had been found. If Mrs. Camden had found out about Theo and Sarah and decided to get rid of her with a false accusation. Perhaps. Why are you up here and not with the rest of the ladies? I stopped working, stopped doing much of anything. They don't like that much. What made you do that? Tears began falling down Sarah's face. No one had really cared much to ask why. I had a baby, and it died. And there was no point after that. The woman took her hand. The baby of your lover? Sarah nodded. He doesn't even know I'm here. They've locked me away, and I don't know what he thinks or what happened. I'm done for. I'm so sorry about the baby. You certainly don't deserve to be tossed in an asylum for something you didn't do. You didn't do it, right? No, I did not. The girl was spending far too much energy on Sarah. She had to be warned. You need to take care of yourself going forward. Don't question the other inmates like this. Not in front of the nurses. You'll get in trouble. The main thing is to not attract attention. Do as they ask. Eat as much as you can. And in the sitting room, sit on the opposite side of the windows. So you have something to look at. The sitting room? You'll find out. Don't try to help anyone. It doesn't end well. But there's a woman, Natalia, who's lovely. If you can, find her. What about you? I don't know if they'll ever let me out of this room. Please don't say that. She walked over and sat beside Sarah, swallowing hard. You are obviously quite sane. I can see that myself. You must promise to keep going for me, and do what they say. Take your own advice, at least for a few weeks. A few weeks, a few days, none of it mattered. Sarah didn't reply. The sun had set and the room grew chilly. It was time for bed. They crawled under their thin blankets and spoke no more.
"Who are you looking for?"
Natalia tapped her spoon on her plate and gave Sarah a crooked smile.
"Prince Charming?"
Sarah glanced over at her friend. For the past 2 weeks, ever since she'd been released back to Hall 6, she looked around in vain for Nellie, hoping to see how her cellmate was faring. Nellie had been taken out of the room the day after her arrival. While Sarah had lingered on for 10 or 12 days longer, she wasn't sure which. Time had become unreliable.
"The girl, Nellie, the one I told you about."
"Right. She was here for a while, but then must have gone to another building."
"But still, then we'd see her outside. It's as if she vanished into thin air."
Natalia sighed.
"Wouldn't that be nice?"
"I hope she wasn't taken to the lodge. She was far from violent. There would be no reason for that."
"You see it all the time. Women who are calm and then turn into savages. You never know. I'm just glad you're back here with me."
"Are you glad?"
Underneath the words was concern. Natalia treated Sarah differently ever since the baby. Like she was fragile. Frail. Maybe she was, deep down. But the emotional and physical crisis, along with the long days and nights in a cell, had hardened her exterior into a tough shell. She did as she was told and didn't ask questions or cause trouble. She knew her place. The asylum had beaten it into her. The baby's death was something to be pushed down, deep, and never thought of again.
"I'm very happy to be back with you, Natalia. Of course."
"I'm sorry our plan didn't work out."
"It is better this way. Imagine the alternative. If it had survived."
She refused to use a gender pronoun to describe the child.
"I guess."
Natalia studied her plate.
"We got fish and potatoes again. A feast."
"Don't question it, enjoy it. Who knows when they'll go back to spoiled beef. What about the new bedsheets? Why do you think they did that?"
Indeed, every inmate had been given a pillow and a warm blanket for their bed. Unheard of luxuries.
"Mrs. Smythe?"
Sarah looked up to see Nurse Alden coming toward her at a brisk clip.
"You must come with me at once."
Sarah looked over at Natalia, whose face had gone gray.
"It's all right. I'll be fine."
But what did they want with her? She hadn't done anything to attract attention. Nothing she could think of. Nurse Alden's eyes were shining.
"Just come along."
Superintendent Dent stood with Dr. Fields in the middle of the octagon's floor. A woman in a well-cut brown wool dress stepped forward. "Nellie."
"My dear Sarah, I'm so glad to see you."
Sarah looked over at Superintendent Dent. Was this a trick?
"You're being released, Mrs. Smythe."
He didn't look pleased and refused to meet her gaze.
"The papers have been signed. Off you go, as the boat is leaving soon."
"I'm going?"
"Yes. You're free."
Chapter 23. New York City. July, 1885.
"I must see Natalia."
Sarah turned back to the dining hall, but Nellie caught her.
"No, there's no time. We'll figure it out. Not now, though."
"Why am I being released?" Superintendent Dent cleared his throat.
"Miss Bly is a reporter, and has cleared your name for you."
"But you were an inmate here just a couple weeks ago."
"I was, as an undercover journalist. Luckily, the press has the power to expose injustice in an unfair, unsafe institution. She stared hard at Superintendent Dent while she spoke. Sarah wasn't sure what that meant, what had happened. Before she could ask another question, she was taken to a room to sign some papers. Then Nellie took her by the arm and they walked outside, where the other inmates milled about.
Sarah!
Natalia ran over, her face a cloud of concern.
Where are you going?
Sarah hugged her friend, the one person who had kept her alive the past many months.
I'm leaving. I've been freed. I'm not sure what happened.
She began to cry.
I can't leave you.
We'll be back, I promise, said Nellie. She put a hand on Natalia's arm. This is the best I can do for now, but there will be more visits. And if Sarah knows your full name and story, we'll see if we can clear you as well.
Her name is Natalia Fabiano, and I can't leave her.
Natalia took Sarah's face in her hands.
Of course you can. You go now.
They hugged. The horn of the boat blew, and Sarah and Nellie made their way to the dock, to the cheers of the inmates. The nurses tried to shush them, but in vain, and Natalia's voice soared above them all.
Sarah Smythe! Don't forget us!
It wasn't until the boat pulled away, and the sailor in front tossed the thick rope onto the dock, that Sarah fully understood the sudden change in the course of her life. Nellie shoved a newspaper into her hands. Sarah pored over the front-page article where the sordid details of Blackwell's Island Insane Asylum were laid out, one after another. The cold baths, the beatings, the sadistic staff, and the hours and hours of torturous sitting, word after terrible word, for the entire city to read. The byline read, Miss Nellie Bly.
You're a hero.
Sarah grabbed Nellie's hand.
You pretended to be mad. What were you thinking?
To be honest, I was thinking that it would make a good story. But once I was there, I realized how truly awful it was, and how no one in the city proper knew what was going on. I was certain that if they knew, they'd care, and I was right. This is only the first step. A commission has been set up, and they've committed $1 million to straighten the place out. $1 million? The sum was unimaginable.
But why have I alone been pardoned? What about the others? Many of the women at Blackwell's are there only because they don't speak enough English to defend themselves.
Believe me, I understand the injustices perpetrated against the women imprisoned on Blackwell's. I'll explain later, at dinner, the reason you are free and they're not. First, we have to get you settled and cleaned up. Don't be offended, but you're rather ripe. In another time, Sarah would have been horrified at the thought, but she couldn't find it in herself to feel embarrassed. She was free. After taking a carriage that was waiting for them on the other side of the river, they pulled up in front of the marble-clad Fifth Avenue Hotel on 23rd Street.
Courtesy of the world, you are getting a well-deserved pampering, announced Nellie. And me too, which I am looking forward to enormously.
A crowd was gathered outside, what looked like newspapermen gathered in a pack. Nellie took her hand.
Ignore them. Follow me. Just walk right through.
Why are they here? Do they know who I am?
Everyone knows who you are, darling.
A bellboy whisked them up the elevator to a suite on the top floor. The room was lavishly appointed, with a red silk bedspread and matching chaise. Purple heart marquetry and Turkish rugs.
This is for me.
Sarah's heart beat fast. The sudden change in her fortune overwhelmed her. What she truly wanted to do was to find Theo, but she'd never be able to leave without stirring up the reporters gathered outside.
All for you. I'll call the maid to run you a bath, and there are several dresses and underclothes to choose from in the armoire. Take your time, and then we'll go down for supper and I'll explain everything.
The warm, welcome buoyancy of the bath nearly did Sarah in. Her hands were chafed and raw, and her limbs seemed like they belonged to someone else. Although she didn't want to see her reflection, the looking glass was too tempting to avoid. The loss of weight made her eyes seem bigger, her skull a massive weight on a scrawny neck. She looked like a creature from a nightmare. A maid helped her into silk underclothes and a fawn-colored gown. After the rough wool and calico of her Blackwell's uniform,